Hi, everyone. For today only, we have an exclusive offer for our week ahead audience. That's our 12/16 flat sale. It's 80% off of a CI Markets premium subscription. That's $99 for the whole year. Access AI-powered forecasts for over 1,600 assets across stocks, ETFs, Forex, commodities, and economics. Updates every Monday morning. With a 94.7% forecast accuracy, this tool is helping traders and investors like you to make smarter decisions and plan portfolios better. Visit CompleteIntel.com/1216flash to get this deal. That's 80% off CI Markets, $99 a year, today only. Thank you. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the week ahead. I'm Tony Nash, and today we're joined by Anthony Cardelli, Michael Belkin, and Tracy Schuchart. We're talking through a number of key themes today. The first is year-end market temptations. Anthony had some really interesting thoughts about things that happen this time of year in markets, so I want to really dive into that a little bit. Michael Belkin has been telling us for months about a market rotation. I want to talk about that and see what, you know, is that still on? And then with Tracy, we'll jump into COP28 and their love of fossil fuels, as we found out this week. So guys, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate the time you take. Anthony, it's great to have you on. Obviously, I've watched you for years. So I want to talk about markets with you. But first, you had a great tweet this week where you said more traders blow up during this time of year than any other time. I think that's super important to be aware of. So can you talk us through that?
It's the psychology shift. It's the mindset changes. It's the I have to do something mindset versus I want to do something. You know, patience a lot of times gets away from traders during this time of the year. And I'm talking specifically when I talk about traders blowing up, you know, my background, independent traders. I'm talking a lot about the traders out there trying to go out there and make it as an independent trader, not talking about traders that have books, just a different world for me. But I think that because those traders have that type of pressure on themselves, I remember my first panic attack, anxiety attack was Christmas morning. I woke up and I didn't have gifts. I was in my early 20s, independent trader, and I didn't have any gifts for anybody. And I just felt this like immense amount of pressure come over me. And I remember during that month leading up to that time, I'm trying to make things happen. And I think that's just a consistent theme when you look at independent traders, investors, that they tend to try and do things that, you know, maybe they wouldn't try and do because they try and turn a buck. You know, there everyone feels the pressure. We have had a year where, regardless of what the data may say, right, inflation's still pretty high out there, I think, for everybody in the mainstream. And so I think that it's just important to understand that you don't have to do anything. You know, I think we put majority of the pressure on ourselves as traders. We're competitors. We want to go out there. We want to do well. We want to perform well. And when you also get into this time of the year and why I think a lot of traders blow up, I think not only because of the psychology, but it's really a different market. I mean, look at this past week. We had biggest options expiration of the year, right? You've got triple witching. You've got, we had an FOMC meeting. We had CPI, PPI. We have all of these crosswinds coming in at once. You have end of the year flows, seasonality. And that really a lot of times is going to cause a lot of either one directional moves. And I think a lot of random volatility, I call it, where all of a sudden bigger players come into the marketplace because they have to do something and they have to do something on a different reason than what I talked about with independent traders having to do something. They have to move money around. You know, you've got, like I said, all the expirations between the futures markets, options markets. And so that's why I think that this time of the year is really unique psychologically and also in terms of, you know, just in trading in general.
Right. It's interesting you use the word saying that traders are trying to make things happen, right? I mean, I think over the last couple of years, it's been pretty easy for people to feel like they can make things happen. And I'm not sure if that is, you know, I almost feel like we're kind of at the end of that to some extent, right? Like that magic that we had in 21 and 22, this year's been a lot harder, right? So as people end this year, you know, I think what you mentioned about like having money for gifts or whatever at the end of the year, like that's a real pressure that everyone feels, right? And yeah. I think a lot of traders feel like they kind of set their own destiny to some extent. Not really, but I think a little bit of that feeling is there. So how do you see people trying to kind of make things happen? Or what are some of the biggest mistakes people make?
I think people just think too much. I think that's really what it comes down to. I think the mistake that they make in terms of actually going out and trading is that they're just thinking too much about all these different things I mentioned that are happening in the marketplace right now. And they don't really take it down to a level of execution, right? I mean, you've got so many financial experts out there talking about what's happening in the market, macro flows versus options flows. I just did a big podcast on this and just all these different crosswinds, like I mentioned. And I think that traders get overwhelmed by it. And then when they get to the screen, they have all of these hidden underlying biases that get in the way of them just trading what's in front of them, you know. And a lot of people will fight the tape because maybe a move is happening. Look how much we've rallied in the Dow and Russell. I mean, I know the NASDAQ and S&P have rallied as well, but look at those markets. You easily can see people stepping in, trying to fade them if they didn't catch a move, or, you know, just trying to go in and trying to make a couple of ticks and, you know, and get in front of a steam train, and they give away, you know, a lot more money than they really anticipated to. So I think the mistake is just overthinking the environments. Instead of just simplifying and saying, okay, look, there's a lot that I don't understand what's happening right now, and that's okay. And come in and just be small and smart. I keep telling our traders in my free Discord, small and smart, don't ruin Christmas.
Yeah. Tracy, you're in the trenches on this stuff. Talk to us about, like, how do you feel at this time of year? Do you feel additional pressure?
I think, you know, mainly because my main focus is energy, it generally tends to be pretty predictable as far as seasonality is concerned. You know, usually we see a low in oil markets, you know, the second to third week in December. And then we see a rally to the end of the year because of tax purposes, because oil companies' tax assessment date is on the 31st of December. And so they try to get rid of as many barrels as possible. And it also correlates to when refinery maintenance season is over. So they're able to ramp up refining. So that works out. So we see big draws generally from the EIA report, which generally leads to a bias to the upside. So, you know, I think looking at the energy industry, it's just a very seasonal kind of market. You know, if I were trading equities, you know, I probably, especially in the futures markets, you know, I think it gets more and more difficult when you start having the notional value increase every year. I mean, we have what, 4.9 trillion dollars of notional value, expiring today. So, you know, and that number keeps growing. And so, you know, I think that gets more and more difficult to trade. And I think that when you get into sort of these passive flows that just keep growing, it gets more and more difficult because you just have computers and buying because that's what they're told to do. So, that's my take on that, Mark, on that.
Quants like Michael, calculating stuff. Enabling those computers. So, okay, that's good. Thanks for that. I think, you know, obviously be careful. Think twice. I like what you say about staying small and all that stuff, Anthony. It's really good to think about it this time of year. Let's talk a little about what happened with central banks this week. You know, the Fed, obviously, everyone knows the news about the Fed. The BOJ is obviously a big consideration. The ECB, you know, does whatever they do to enable the hollowing out of European economy. But, you know, we saw on Wednesday, Powell presented a very dovish look forward, very dovish. Equities kind of accept the NASDAQ. Equities loved it. Small caps loved it. Commodities loved it. So is this, and all three of you guys, Anthony, let's start with you, but, you know, all three of you guys, is this the end of cuts and our rates just flat for the next, you know, X months or whatever. On screen, I have a survey I've done looking at when the first rate cut is expected. And, you know, half the respondents, more than half the respondents believe it'll happen in the second half of 24 or later. That's changed, obviously shifted a little bit earlier since the Wednesday meeting. So is this the end of rate cuts? And are we going to see dramatic dovishness with the Fed? Anthony, let's start with you.
And so you think it's the end of rate hikes, right?
Sorry, rate hikes. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yes, rate hikes. Yeah.
I know, because our minds are already on cuts, right? And, you know, to be clear, I'm not a macro trader, but what I look at is an overall theme, right? This was a shift.
Yep.
Bottom line. I mean, you know, the dot plots, take them for what they're worth, right? Are showing three next year. I immediately went to CME's Fed Watch tool and I looked to see what they were going to be pricing in through the Fed Fund futures. And they're looking at six rate cuts heading into next year, I think starting obviously in Q1. And so do I think this is the end of rate hikes? I mean, if we take the Fed for their word, I think that's what we're looking at. I mean, the market took that statement and things changed. Market environment changed. Now they rattled the cage. So yeah, I think that we're at the end of rate hikes.
Okay. Michael, what are your thoughts?
I remember when I was a kid going to Disneyland, there's this ride called Mr. Toad's Wild Ride.
Yes.
Smashing into walls and stuff. To me, that's like the Fed steering the economy. You know, they're always, it's out of control. Or, you know, it's blowback. They're always doing the wrong thing at the wrong time for too long. And then, so if you go back a couple steps, so we had COVID, they threw an insane amount of stimulus at the economy. Then they said, inflation's not a problem, it's transitory. Then they raise interest rates by 500 something basis points. And now they say everything's okay. And maybe, you know, all of a sudden, so there was a change, but my work says we're headed into a recession. Okay. And interest rates are going to drop sharply, the economy. So all my economic stuff. So I do forecasting, right? Time series analysis, forecast, direction, position, intensity, looking for turning points and things. And so industrial production, capacity utilization, retail sales, even though the numbers should look a little bit stronger lately, I think this is a major inflection point. And that goes as well for corporate earnings. So basically, I think the Fed's going to be, they're usually the caboose, you know, they decide to change too late after everything's changed. And I think this is incredibly bearish. So if you go back to me, like this is a moment like 2000, March 2000, or, you know, after that, but never, nothing's ever exactly like anything else, but this is a major inflection point in the economy, similar to late 2007, early 2008, or 2000, 2001. And so I think there's going to be big surprises coming from the private sector. And put this in perspective. So the Fed started tightening March 2022, right? So that's 21 months or something now. The average lag in monetary policy hitting the economy is like 18 months. You know, it's not brain surgery, but we get a major downturn. Steve Hanke's really great on this. You know, he's a monetary economist at Johns Hopkins. And I don't follow him real closely, but I totally agree with everything he's saying. So I think the economy is going to, I don't think this is a soft landing. I think we're headed into something more like a crash landing, not today, this afternoon or, you know, this week or before the end of the year, but generally things are turning down. Interest rates go down. Right now, the market is perceiving that as bullish, you know, short-term traders. Oh, the Fed's done hiking. It's time for me to buy stocks. You know, I mean, that's so ingrained. It's like one factor model. Okay, but you go back and look at 2000 to 2002, 2003, or 2007, 2009, Fed was cutting rates aggressively. The economy crashed and stocks, the S&P went down by 50%. So I think the psychology in the market's completely wrong. And I'm collecting all these press clips. One of the things I do in the Belkin Report is press clips. It's all disastrous, like recession in Germany, recession in Japan, China, nothing's working. You know, I mean, we get these numbers that they always revise down. They look great in the U.S. at first, then they revise them down a couple months later, you know. So anyways, I think the Fed's going to be cutting rates, but I think the psychology doesn't yet reflect that that's bearish. So there's going to be this, I think, mental change coming for investors, maybe not before the end of the year, but, you know, I just have the opposite read on this that the market's getting at the moment.
Can I ask Michael something real quick?
Absolutely. Michael,
I appreciate your thoughts on this. And I do agree with you that at some point, this is probably something that turns into a bearish situation. And I think when you see what happens at the end of a bull market or a big rally, right, you see this type of news that accelerates it. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing here. And so it almost creates a scenario for a blow off top, obviously with seasonality, end of the year, going into, you know, the beginning of January, where it creates this bullishness. I think that this news is just accelerating that flow, which almost is like a capitulation type top. And part of me thinks, is this inverted yield curve actually starting to come into play, where people are starting to see that, you know, everybody was talking about how this was going to cause a recession. And my question to you is, is that playing a role? Do you think that played a role in what the Fed was looking at? Like, maybe we've over tightened, you know, this yield curve inversion is still there. And ultimately, like, there is some fear behind this. And so that's why you're thinking that it could be eventually a bearish signal to the market.
Yeah, I was actually surprised to see Powell, sort of capitulate. I agree, you know, so the market has been saying the yield curve and a lot of this economic data. I mean, you can't read this stuff and not understand that the global economy is headed down. So back to your point about the market making a blow off top. So before each recession of those major recessions I mentioned, 2000s in the early 2000s and then 2008 area, the market made a high right before that. It kind of didn't make any sense. Like, so it went up and went up for kind of no reason, where the news was bad. Then it reversed sharply. So I think that's what we're setting up for. I think it's really if you're buying the market here, you believe in buying high. Okay, it's buy high, and I think they're going to end up selling low. So my model is looking for turning points. I looked for things like buy low, you know, the health maxim: buy low, sell high. So to me, this is a sell high moment, and that's just for the indexes. But if you look, let me just talk for a second about what's going on beneath the surface. Okay, so hang on. So I'm my top sectors. I do a lot of work.
Hold on, Michael. Sectors. Can we get into that in just a minute?
In a second. Okay.
I want to do that in the next segment, if you don't mind.
Sure, no problem.
But I do want to continue this Fed discussion just in terms of things like your process flexibility and rigidity and your duration. You know, how do those change when we're in inflection points like this? Tracy, let's start with you. Like, how does your process change, or does it change when you're in situations like this? Does your duration change when we're in timeframes like this?
Well, absolutely. Well, first of all, I want to go back and say, you know, Powell's 180 in kind of dovish stance scared me, to be honest, because that made me think, what is the Fed seeing that we're not seeing in the data? Clearly, yep, there is a deterioration of the data, but not enough to literally do a 180 and start being that dovish. And so that frightened me right away. I also have to agree with Michael that I think we do see some sort of blow off top. To me, this kind of looks like the end of 1999, heading into 2000, and then when we had that huge drop off, like starting, say, November 1999, it kind of looks like right now, where we may see a little bit of pullback, we may see a little bit of volatility, then we see this blow off top, and then this market has a real problem, say, you know, starting end of Q1, beginning of Q2. That's kind of what this market feels like to me. I also think we're going to have a huge problem, because if we look at the inflation situation, I think we are in stagflation. I don't care what anybody says, because inflation is still very persistent. And I think that this looks like a 1970s scenario. What's going to happen is, you know, Powell is going to be faced with a situation where he may have to cut rates, but that's going to send inflation out the door again. Right, in my opinion. So I think, you know, that's what I'm looking at in the market, let's say, over the next two quarters.
Okay. Great. So Does
Lego great? Hey,
how does no? That's good.
I don't know if that answered your question, but that's really what I'm looking at.
No, I think that definitely addresses certainly what Michael said, that we're going from this. Well, first of all, the Fed isn't telling us what they're seeing, I think, right? There's something that they're seeing that really has shocked the leadership, and they're conveying that. That's a weird 180. It's a great point, right? And that should worry us. And as we see interest rate cuts, obviously that reduces margins that company, you know, the record margins we've had over the last couple of years, that reduces margins for companies as well. So earnings are probably going to be kind of scary, especially for, you know, some of these retailers or, you know, casual dining or, you know, even tech as, you know, as some of these, say budgets are pulled in, that sort of thing. Right. So it could be kind of scary, but I guess, just going back to my last question about your process, when you see what you saw on Wednesday with Powell changing his tone dramatically, how does that change your process? Does your duration get shorter? Does your process change? How do you, Tracy, adjust when you see things like this?
Oh, well, my first thought was this market's going to love this, which it does. And so my first thought was I need to start buying some sort of protection in February or March, because I think, you know, I think that this, you know, the up low off top could come. The market's taking this the wrong way initially. And, you know, with it, I mean, protection is very cheap right now. And so, you know, that was my first go-to is, you know, let's kind of look at some puts in February, March and see what's going on there.
Great. So you're looking at kind of a 2 month horizon for something like this to happen.
I would say Q1, Q2. I think that's going to be a pivotal point. I think that we'll know by the end of Q2. And I, you know, if, you know, being that it's so cheap right now, you know, so I have protection against a long portfolio. I'm fine with great. That. If I take a loss on that, then.
That's great. Anthony, how about you? How does your process and duration change, if at all, when something like this happens?
Well, for me, I'm primarily a short-term swing trader, day trader. So when it comes to that process, it's really just understanding what is the current environment. And obviously that has shifted underlying bid in bonds and treasuries, underlying bid in gold, you know, favor trading the Russell to the long side more than NASDAQ and S&P because of the impact of interest rates, I think is going to let the Russell outperform those indexes going forward. So you have that shift. And I also manage my own longer term portfolio, a portion of it, not all of it, because I don't want it all in my hands because I could sometimes get a little aggressive. But I think overall, I've already been in IWM. So I've been long small caps just because I felt that this whole year was really a bull market. I didn't know eventually that they would catch up. They've now caught up dramatically. And I own a bunch of tech stocks. I think for my longer term duration stuff, I use this strength to start taking my risk down. You know, I mean, I think if you've already been long, I think you start taking risk down. You know, it's funny, this whole year, nobody wanted to call it a bull market. And go back to kind of what Michael said, right? You know, it's like these people are buying high, and that's what happens at the end of big rallies of bull markets, right? And so it's funny, those that have not participated are now in a rush to participate. And I always look at that from a long-term investor, the stuff that I've been in. And like I said, I own a bunch of tech stocks. I own the small caps. I'm going to start peeling that stuff off, you know, into the next quarter, right? And just reduce my risk. Because it's my long-term portfolio, I probably won't be out of everything. But and we'll wait and see, and I'll let price dictate that. I don't know when this all of a sudden shifts, but it just feels like right now the momentum is so strong technically. And, you know, we can argue whether or not fundamentally it makes sense to be buying stocks now because interest rates are coming down. That's what the market thinks. And so as a trader, as an investor, I look at it and go, maybe I ride this tail a little bit, but there will start to be signs when you start to see things start to soften up, and then I adjust from there.
Yeah, I mean, we had this article this morning that everybody's been talking about. There's a $6 trillion cash hoard that could fuel more stock gain as the Fed pivots. We're talking basically they're saying buy the highs, buy the highs. And so, you know, I mean, when you get into this, this reminds me of like the mania, right? And so eventually that mania always reverts to the mean, in my opinion.
When has that ever worked, right? When everyone told you it's now time to buy because all the paths are clear and we're at all time highs, right? It's like, it's going to work for a period of time, most likely, right? Yeah. But that period of time, you know, as fast as we come up in price, as fast as we can count on price.
Twice as fast.
Right. And that's why duration is important, right? And so anyway, we're in the middle of a Santa Claus rally, right? So it's just, you know, let's...
Yay.
I would not be fading it now.
I definitely wouldn't step in front of this market, right?
Yeah. let's move to Michael. And Michael, you know, you've talked about a rotation for quite some time. And, you know, you've talked about getting out of tech, getting into things like financials. And so with the Fed dovishness, I'd like to look at a few different things. I'd like to really start looking at the dollar. We saw the dollar start to pull back pretty dramatically on Wednesday. And we've got a chart up showing your dollar direction. Can you talk to us about that? Where and why do you expect the dollar to move? And over what duration do you expect the dollar to pull back?
Okay, so this kind of backwards segues into what you're talking about a second ago. How did the Fed, pivot change my feelings or my forecast? So not really too much. So the Belkin Report had been saying short the dollar, be long bonds for months, right? Okay, so that's been working. And believe me, I've been wrong on other stuff. So I'm not boasting here by any stretch of the imagination. But
it's okay to boast.
To me, it was like, hello, where have you been? You know, I mean, like people, so if you look at the sentiment stuff, so people were buying the dollar against the yen. They were shorting the yen like crazy right before this all thing happened. And then the yen all of a sudden rallies like crazy. And same thing with bonds. So bonds are up enormously now from they bottomed. So the bond market bottomed on October 19th. Okay. It's just a couple months ago, right? November, December. Right, you know, it's almost a 2 month anniversary and it's up enormously. And if I could just go over a couple of what's happened this week. So let's just forget about what the indexes are doing. But a lot of what I do is focused on sector rotation. Mm-hmm. So the bank's KBE ETF is up 8% this week. So the S&P is up a little over 2% at the moment. Gold stocks, GDX, up 5.1%. TLT, that's T-bond, is up 5%. So bonds are up twice as much as the S&P. To me, that's really a key, super critical thing here. So another comparison I'd like to make is 1987. So I've been hired into Salomon in 1986, Salomon Brothers. I was in market analysis. I ended up in proprietary trading, being the quantitative strategist, four-man unit running the house account on the equity side. But I remember in the summer of 87, seeing the market go up, 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 up. And Greenspan had come in and was raising interest rates. And the market went up for no good reason, except for algorithmic buying, you know, portfolio insurance in those days. Then it peaked in August, sold off in September, came back, rolled over again. And the critical issue there was bonds relative to stocks. So that's one of the things I do, relative value trades. So ratio things. So long TLT, short S&P 500. So in ETFs, that's TLT, SPY. That has outperformed by 2% this week. And that might not sound significant to an individual investor, but if you're like a big pension fund or something, so what happened to tie this, you know, back into what happened in 87, we had a huge pension fund, General Motors pension fund, dump all its stocks going into the 87 crash and shift into bonds. And a lot of other institutions were shifting into bonds. So the shift by asset allocators out of stocks, which look overvalued, into bonds, which look undervalued, that's happening kind of in slow motion. But to flesh this out a little bit further. So again, the Belkin model looks to buy low and sell high. And that's not just in absolute terms, but relative terms. So one of the biggest advances this week is solar stocks. TAN is the ETF. And some of these stocks are up enormously. These are down. So these are stock, this ties into what Anthony was saying about, the Russell 2000, smaller stocks, some of those have been really depressed and left behind by the market. Those are going up way more than tech. So the biggest declining sector this week is communication services. That's FANG, that's VAG 7, you know, that's Google and Meta. That's, you know, that's underperformed the index by almost 2% this week.
Okay, so let's talk about that for a minute. Sorry, just to pause there, because you have a good chart on that showing basically you think we've hit, you know, we're pushing down there. So I want to put that chart on screen as you're talking through it. So can you talk through Mag 7 a little bit and where that's going?
Yeah, so sentiment and positioning is critically important. So what I do is time series analysis, but I look very closely at sentiment. Some of my hedge fund clients, that's the biggest thing. They want to know where people are positioned. They're overly positioned. So they're run far to the one side of the boat, the boat's tipping over, they run to the other side. So Mag 7 is obviously the most over-owned thing out there. Everybody and his brother. They're long these things. It looks bulletproof. All the stock analysts, oh, they're so great. The earnings are good. Blah, blah, blah. So you got to own them. So that's what everybody owns. And if you look at the top Goldman Sachs, the top longs of hedge funds versus their top shorts, they're getting crucified this week. So their top longs are underperforming the market, all these Mag 7 kind of stocks, and their shorts are going up. So there's this huge like squeeze going on beneath the surface. I also like to talk about gold. Is that okay?
Yeah. You have this gold CDE versus 200 average. Can we talk through that as well?
Okay. Yeah. So gold is the flip side of the dollar. Okay. Dollar goes down, gold goes up. So Belkin Report has been saying, sell the dollar, buy gold. And gold has been in the doldrums. Nobody wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole. You know, went from the penthouse to the shithouse, pardon my French. And so all of a sudden, it's starting to come back, but it's really depressed. And so I do a retail gold stock report, which covers every investable gold stock, not Moose Pasture, not Vancouver, you know, Hope in a Dream stocks, but stocks that have revenues, you know, production, reserves. And my number one pick this week and number two in previous weeks was Coeur Mining, CDE. That stock's up 20% this week. So that's the number one stock recommendation in the Belkin report. And again, I'm not boasting because the market's going up and I'm finding it. But so the things that are going beneath the surface of the market, it's not what you'd think. So bonds outperforming, GDX up 5% versus S&P 2%. TAN, you know, solar stocks up 12%. What's that? Five times as much as the S&P. Bank stocks up 8%. That's three times as much as the S&P. And then things that are underperforming. Oh, by the way, real estate. So here's another, I didn't really mention that, but real estate is up 6%. This XLRE ETF, that's the REIT ETF. It's up almost three times as much as the S&P this week. So things that are really depressed, I think people are rotating out of. And again, back to the idea of asset allocators rotating out of stocks into bonds. I think that's just starting. And that can be really convulsive as we witnessed in 87. I mean, our trading floor at Salomon Brothers was convulsed. I mean, we didn't know, you know, in going into the 87 crash, it was the days of paper tickets, you know, order tickets. It wasn't digital anything. And it was just frozen. Nobody knew what we were getting filled or what, you know, the whole thing was in a state of suspended animation. So I'm not saying we're going into market's going to go down 20% in a day or something, but I disagree with the other panelists here saying, looking for a top further out, you know, end of first quarter or something. I think we're in a reversal zone here, and the tech stuff, you know, you got to remember these Mag 7 stocks are about 30% of the S&P 500 and about 50% of the NASDAQ 100. And if these things start going down, this other stuff could go up, but you get this great rotation. But if you're an index player, forget about it. You know, I mean, the indexes are going to be heavy if people rotate out of these big name, high cap tech stocks and they start going down and this other stuff starts going up. So this gets back to like 2000 rotation. You know, back when the tech bubble peaked, there was a wonderful rotation into financials and utilities, real estate, consumer staples, defensive high yielding stocks. While tech went down, you know, the NASDAQ went down almost 90% or something, you know, over the next couple of years. And all this other stuff went up for a year or two. So I think there's a great opportunity in rotation, but not in the stuff. It's the exact opposite of what people, you know, what people have been doing for the last few months, you know, just reflexively buying Mag 7 stocks over and over and over every morning.
I mean, they haven't lost on it, so it's not terrible, right? They haven't lost on it yet. So, but Michael, let's talk. You mentioned financial sectors, so let's talk a little bit about that. You have a chart on the financial sector to the S&P 500 ratio, and you know, keep in mind the charts that people are seeing. They came out on Monday, I think, right? And the Fed meeting happened on Wednesday. So, what you're putting out, pretty prescient, given you know the things that the Fed said.
Right. So the financial XLF is up 3.5% so far this week. It's 1% more than the S&P. That doesn't sound like a lot. But so what my model is, time series analysis, gives direction, position, intensity. I'm looking at a 12 period forward forecast. Right now, we're only in like about the second inning of financials outperforming the S&P. And if you again, the sentiment, people don't want banks. You know, the banks are failing, regional banks. That's all that. Oh, they've lost, they got such big losses on their bonds. But now the bonds are rallying, right? So that's kind of mitigating the things. I'm not saying buy the world's worst banks, but generally
helps that duration risk a little bit, right?
Yeah. So, but again, the KBE, the bank ETF, up 8% this week. Hello. Mm-hmm. I mean, is anybody, am I the only one to even notice that? So I think, so my clients are big asset managers for the most part, you know, some huge, almost $1 trillion companies, some of them, you know, and these guys, they have to be fully invested or maybe they can raise a certain amount of cash. But so I talk to them and they say, well, if I'm going to sell something, what do I buy? If I have to buy, So what do I sell or what do I buy? That's what the Belkin Report tries to do. So I've been telling them, get out of this Mag 7 stuff, rotate into things that are down in relative terms, which is XLRE, real estate, banks, XLF, KBE, gold stocks, GDX, and also utilities and staples, which nobody likes.
Great. Okay. So it sounds interesting. It sounds like we're definitely moving away from where we've been since, say, 2021, which it's about time, right? I mean, I think a little bit of this stuff is kind of a little bit tired. So glad to see that. What do you guys think about this rotation, Anthony and Tracy? Are you guys, do you see the same? Maybe not exactly, but we seem to be at the cusp of a rotation. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. We're seeing value bid over, say, tech, which I call like the PAP loves dog bid, right? Every time there's a dip, somebody wants to buy tech.
Right.
But I think it's very interesting that we are seeing depressed value stocks kind of get a bid, coincided with the dovish Fed, right? Mm. So what are what are these big guys really seeing? What it does, you know, Powell have them spooked? I don't know, you know, follow the money. And so When you see these kind of rallies in particularly the hard assets, obviously that's my area of focus, but you know, when you see them in, you know, industrial metals, precious metals, energy sector, things of that nature, you know, that generally tells me that there is kind of, you know, being shipped, and you know, and that people with a lot more money than we do, you know, are foreseeing something that the Fed is doing or saying that they're uncomfortable with at this stage. It also tells me a lot about inflation, because what that says is to me is that, you know, with these 6 rate cuts factored into the market from the CME Fed Watch tool, I know that the dot plot's at like 3, I think. Either way, you know, what this says to me is inflation is not done by any stretch of the imagination, and people are buying into inflationary tending assets such as energy, metals, and whatnot. Because I think what I fear is that you'll have rate cuts and it's too early, it's too soon, and then we have inflation roaring back like the 1970s.
Yep. Anthony, are you kind of, in terms of rotation, are you on board?
Well, when I look at tech, like I said, I mean, in my longer term portfolio stuff, I own a few of the Magnificent Seven. You know, I'm very heavily weighted right now on Russell, and I just think that the rotation's already begun. I mean, you're seeing everybody rotating into small caps. I thought it was interesting that Michael talked about the solar. I might follow up a question with him on that because I'm kind of curious about it. But yeah, but I also look at it from a seasonality time of year. I look at where the markets are from a technical basis. Tracy talked about how much on the sidelines that could come in. Tracy, what'd you say? 6 trillion, something like that.
Ridiculous. Yes.
Yeah. And so I look at that and go, momentum is on the side of the bulls right now. And I just think that I think the rotation's beginning, but I just don't see, you know, a fallout in these major tech stocks right now. I think that it's going to take time. And I think that that's why I'm looking at it more as we rally. I'll be peeling off risk, not adding risk. And I'm talking about my longer term stuff over the next quarter or so, just because I think momentum carries through because of time of year and because of just, like I said, that money that comes in now, because we go back to where we started. You know, this is a sentiment shift, right? Everybody's fighting that this is a bear market. Not everybody, but a lot of people, a lot of the year. It's now a bull market. It's now in the headlines. You've now got a lot of retail money coming in. And just in my experience, it's as we're making highs, you know, all-time highs in some of the indexes, it's hard to see a rotation right now. Like I'm still in the camp that we will see some sort of blow off top, capitulation isk type move, just because the flows are so one-dimensional right now. And I think that, you know, I don't see a reason to change my mind, but the tape will prove me right or wrong nonetheless. And I think you know, it's just, I think it's a time thing is more of the way I look at it.
That's why we have markets, because we have differences of opinion. It's great. I love that.
Can I ask Michael a question real quick about the solar? I'm just curious about it because I think it's interesting. Michael, from your research, when it comes to why the solar stocks are doing well right now, I mean, it's not like oil is rallying. It's and I know that we're in an election year, so I'm not necessarily sure how much that plays into the solar as well. But is it really just because maybe interest rates are coming down, because a lot of these solar companies are borrowing from banks, and maybe that's just a lower interest rate? Is that what's triggering it? I'm just curious. Why that maybe that solar space is something that's doing so well right now?
Possibly that's one influence. I suspect it's that it's caught up in short. It might be a short squeeze because they're not the greatest companies, right?
That's why.
Yeah. So you kind of, I'm saying buy solar stocks, kind of hold your nose, you know. I mean, but these things are up enormously this week. They're at the Belkin Report. So SPWR, SEDG, RUN, NOVA, HASI, things like this. I mean, you know, I used to be part of this short selling group that would get together every year. I'm still invited, but I haven't been able to go in the last few years. But these are the kind of companies that stock analysts probably hate. You know, they look, even though Biden has been throwing enormous amounts of money, you know, solar energy subsidies. So I think, you know, maybe that it's a buy low, sell high thing. Things that hedge funds hate, that they've been selling and shorting, that have been underperforming. By the way, this is a new position for me. It goes back about 2 or 3 weeks. So these were on my sell and short list. The Belkin Report's not a broken clock. So these were previously sell and underperform recommendations in the Belkin Report, you know, until a month or so ago. Now they're working as longs. So I think it's more just like a buy low, sell high rotation, is looking for things that are down. That's a normal kind of end of the year sort of thing. So if you're looking for a fundamental reason, might be hard to find, but it's just, you know, order flow, sentiment, positioning, direction, position intensity. That's what I do. It's
best I can say. It's an interesting to me because I'm thinking about this. If this is happening overall in the market, I'm just curious what Michael and Tracy think. Isn't that a bullish thing? I mean, that's why it's hard for me to be bearish up here at all, really, because anytime it's a rotation where I'm seeing the weak stuff getting bought up, and my experience in bull markets, I've seen that be a very bullish signal, at least in the short to medium term. And that's part of why I'm looking at it going, you know, this could carry that momentum into what we consider a blow-off type top-ish scenario. I'm not projecting that's what will happen, but I just think that the action I'm seeing is bullish.
Anthony, you sound a lot like Tony Greer right now. And I mean that as a compliment.
Well, it's the everything bid.
My guy.
You know, everything's bid right now. But if you look, relatively speaking, we are seeing value start to outperform, at least this week, outperform traditional tech stocks. And so I think that is just kind of a shift in investor sentiment or money manager sentiment or, you know, a big player sentiment.
Can I hop in there?
Absolutely.
So with the Mag 7 being 50% of the NASDAQ, I think that's negative for the market. So to me, I said this before, but I'll just repeat. I don't know if you were around in 2000, but the rotation then was the S&P kind of held in 2000 after the tech bubble top, but it was all held up by these defensive stocks that big portfolio managers rolled, and while tech was crashing, you know, so the NASDAQ was going down while the S&P held in, the NASDAQ underperformed. So I hate overlaying one chart over another chart and expecting the same thing to happen. That doesn't usually work out. But you get similarities, you know, things rhyme. And so I think we're more in a situation like that where you do not want to be in the NASDAQ. And also the VIX, we talked a little bit about it, but the VIX is insane right now. I mean, it's so ridiculously low. And when you know, it's depressed by, there are funds that sell options. There are a lot of ETFs now that sell options for income. That's part of it. There's a, I don't know who all the different participants are. They're selling volatility. But if you get, you know, to me, the VIX is a screaming buy. So that means puts are cheap, even calls it. But, you know, if the skew is not there, it's not, then the distant ones aren't so cheap. But basically, when the VIX starts going up, the market starts going down and you get wilder swings. So I would say temper your bullishness. I mean, on the, you know, I'm not telling you what to do, but just in general, the forecast is for the NASDAQ to underperform. So the stuff that everybody's been buying, I could see the NASDAQ going down while these other things, you know, the Russell, the things you're talking about, some of these other things go up for a month or two, but not hugely, not, you know, it's not like a massive bull market breakout, but I'm more of a rotation. But definitely I'm not bullish on the NASDAQ. You know, I think it's really overdone, overowned, and people, I know these hedge funds are feeling pressure because these stocks are underperforming. And if you're 30% of your portfolio is in these things and you're getting negative alpha, you know, people are tapping on your shoulder. Your boss is saying, well, you know, what do we do? What do we do with Meta? What are we doing with Google? What are we doing with Alphabet? What are we doing with Microsoft? So I think it's negative for the NASDAQ.
Great. Okay, let's, since Anthony asked about solar, you know, we just had the COP28 meetings earlier this week, and maybe that's why everyone's excited about solar, who knows? But message we got out of, you know, we had a lot of gushing analysis of COP28 in the UAE this past week, and it seems like every climate warrior was super happy about it. But based on the wording of the final resolution, Tracy, it seems like you don't necessarily think that there's a lot of reason for those guys to celebrate. Can you tell us what you've observed? And I've got a tweet of yours on the screen.
Okay.
Observed and how markets seem to be reading into the news.
Well, I think, okay, when we have to start, and I just clipped in that tweet, is just a clip of that specific energy section of it. It's 28, 29, and 30. And I think what you have to read in this market is this whole time, you know, let's put it this way. They missed two deadlines to come to a resolution. They went overtime into a third before they came to a resolution. The big—
Does that usually happen? Does it usually take that much for these?
Well, no, actually, last COP28, it did over coal, and they decided to leave coal out of it.
Okay.
So it's happened, but not like twice. It is kind of rare that it's twice. So my argument is everybody was thrilled about, you know, this because they mentioned transitioning from fossil fuels. Now, here's my argument about this whole thing. And that was, I think, 28D, if you look on that chart, is transitioning from fossil fuels. what everybody really wanted in that, what the environmentalists wanted in that, was the words phasing out. So really the oil and gas industry kind of won on that point, even though they all cheered. There are a lot of renditions of that statement, but ultimately it came out something much more watered down than, let's say, the zealots, environmentalists really wanted.
Right.
And then we have to look at coal, and that was 28B. Now, that initial wording started at, we're going to rapidly phasing down. And what ended up was, we're going to accelerate our efforts towards a phase down. So, I mean, all this language has been very much watered down. What is also really interesting is that if you look at 29 recognizes that transitional fuels can play a role in facilitating energy transition. That means natural gas. Now, natural gas was a big point of contention last year, and they didn't want that involved at all. So to me, this says, oh my God, well, maybe people are realizing we just can't jump from, you know, fossil fuels to nothing to solar. And then, sorry, my last point I just have to make is 28E, which is a big win for the nuclear industry because it's been shunned from COP throughout its history, finally got a mention as a fuel. So I think that's exciting for the nuclear industry.
Yeah, and that's, they talk
about breakdown of that.
It's a great breakdown. In 2080, they talk about low carbon hydrogen production, which, you know, again, is a kind of a nod to natural gas, right? So, you know, it's interesting that Anthony mentioned with the solar, his solar question to Michael, he talked about interest rates potentially falling to help out these solar firms. Do you think, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on the show, if we do have this 180 pivot from the Fed, given where interest rates are, do you think that it was an acknowledgement from COP28 that it's tougher to transition to kind of these green power generation approaches with interest rates, even at the level they are now, much less whether they either rise or fall, depending on where we are in a year? Do you think this is kind of a nod to how expensive it is to deploy those technologies?
I think it's a nod to how expensive it is to deploy any technology or any source of energy at interest rates this high, because we have to know, and you know, this has been a major theme throughout this entire year, throughout starting from the Ukraine-Russia invasion, right? India decided we're still buying Russian oil, we get it cheap. China, we're still, everybody was, you know, energy security is our focus. We don't really care what the United States says, what the West says. And so I think what was a notable shift in this COP28 is they gave, you know, with interest rates this high, because all of these energy products projects are very capital intensive. They require a ton of capital at borrowing rates that are skyrocketing.
And as so countries are running out of fiscal
power. Exactly. Right. Nobody has, you have emerging markets right now defaulting on debt payments. We just saw this with Ethiopia. We've seen this in multiple countries in Africa. So, you know, this is a very tough time, skyrocketing rates, especially for emerging markets that are looking for energy security. So in my opinion, this is a long way around of saying it. In my opinion, when we look at COP28 this year, I think it's very interesting that I think that they say they got what they wanted, but I would say this was a big win for the oil and gas and the nuclear industry over any other technology, to be honest with you.
Okay. I also want to ask you about coal. Obviously, China and India and other places continue to build coal plants because people need cheap energy. These are emerging markets. They need low-cost energy and all this stuff to power their electric cars. So if we look at 28B, and it talks about the phase down of unabated coal power. Right. What is unabated coal power?
So what they're saying is that we don't want you to keep adding coal plants you know, and using this as kind of your backup plan, which, you know, we know China has. I mean, China hasn't stopped building coal plants, even though they have built nuclear, they have built out hydro, they have built out all this other technology, solar, wind, et cetera, but they still haven't scaled down any sort of coal production and or coal energy electric source of electricity, in other words.
Because so they need the coal to power the EVs.
Yes. I know I caught that the first time.
Yes. Sorry. I just wanted to
absolutely. I know. And you know, you find the same thing with India, right? You have growing populations. They don't want to, you know, they want exactly what they see the West has, right? So they need cheap energy. They have growing populations. This makes perfect sense for them economically speaking. And so of course they're not going to stop, and they don't really care what the West says, to be honest.
No, and it's really cynical of the West to force this stuff down the emerging markets throat when the West used this cheap energy to build out our infrastructure and our industry. So why are we now forcing these other places to spend huge money on green energy when a coal plant or a nat gas plant or whatever is—
And using it as a carrot for we'll give you money for this project if we can shove this renewable project down your throat, right? Yeah, and exactly. You know, and this is where we're seeing a lot of conflict in Africa right now. And I digress. Well, that's a whole nother subject for another day, but that's what we just saw in Niger. That's, you know, there's a lot of conflict going on against the West, a lot of military coups happening against Western nations, kind of throwing their views down their throat, so to speak.
So I want to ask you one more very specific question. I don't want to get Anthony and Michael to come in. In 28H, they talk about phasing out of inefficient fossil fuel subsidies that do not address energy poverty or just transitions as soon as possible. So they're interested in phasing out fossil fuel subsidies, but there's no mention of subsidies for, say, green fuels and EVs and, you know, all this stuff. So they're happy to continue to subsidize those fuel sources, but you can't subsidize fossil fuels.
Yes. And to be honest, I think that language is also pretty watery. I wouldn't be surprised to see that, you know, kicked down. You have to realize this is a bunch of, pardon my language, but a bunch of blowhards that come together to decide the fate of the world. And, you know, many of these goals cannot be reached, but they all walk away, pat themselves on the back, say, oh, we did a good job. We're, you know.
Oh, yeah. They went to a great hotel in Dubai and had some great meals.
Exactly. And so at the end of the day, you know, I wouldn't take any of these resolutions from any COP28 as law. This is how it's going to be. I expect every year it's going to rapidly change. Again, this year, the biggest rapid change that we saw was kind of a nod to nuclear and a nod to natural gas, which is a huge 180 from literally the last decade.
Okay. And last question for me, and then I'll turn it over to these guys. How much of the kind of stance on this statement had to do with the fact that it was in the UAE? Do you think because it was in the Middle East, they were more amenable to being friendly to nat gas?
I don't think so. You know, there's been 28 COPs. We've had 13 of them in oil producing nations.
Okay.
Some of them more than once. And next year is going to be in Azerbaijan. So in Baku. So, you know, I to say that oil and gas got a nod just because it was in an oil producing country, I would say is kind of, I think that's what they liked. I think that's a narrative they like to push. But in all reality, 13 other major oil producing nations have hosted this meeting before.
Okay. Michael, I got a couple nods out of you as I was asking some questions. What are your thoughts on this?
Okay, well, let me preface what I say with saying I live on a rural island outside of Seattle, and I'm a mountain biker. I ride almost every day, even in the winter, mud, rain, snow, whatever, light snow. And I have to, on my way to the forest, I have to drive up the road. And luckily, a lot of people have Teslas and Rivians and stuff like that around here, but there's still a lot of diesel trucks. So I have to breathe this stuff when I'm riding. So I'm not, you know, I'm not like a hard-nosed energy person. But I have to say that there's almost a religious cult pseudoscience about climate. And I'll just have one thing to say about it. So there's a story today that came out. Now scientists say breathing is bad for the environment.
I posted that today.
Gases we exhale contribute to 0.1% of the UK's greenhouse emissions.
They want you to stop breathing now, seriously.
Yeah. So there's these pseudoscientists, mostly hard left, they sit in ivory towers and they come up with these models. And I'm a modeler, you know, I mean, I'm a statistical yep. modeler. And I was at Berkeley, you know, I came out of the UC Berkeley Business School and Stat Department, and I was in classes with some of these people that, you know, were pre-med, they were taking stat classes. And so they have this, you know, they basically know the conclusion that they want, and they come up with this data, this absurd data to support these crazy things. So I'm glad to say, that's all I have to say about it. I'm glad to see that this was watered down. And believe me, I don't, you know, I'm not in favor of having smoke, you know, coal-fired utility plants and all that stuff. We obviously have to do something about that. But the religious pseudoscience,
right.
cult science from the hard left on this, I mean, it's really, it resembles what happened in the COVID pandemic, where a lot of these people were modeling all these things saying hundreds of millions of people were going to die or something. So we have to lock everything down. So, you know, it's dangerous to the economy and to the markets to have people that have no idea what they're talking about. They're on some ivory tower academic pulpit, you know, coming out with these BS studies.
So I mean, for those of you who aren't quants and aren't modelers, both Michael and I build models. If we wanted to show Apple at a $10 stock price or a $10,000 stock price, if we went into that exercise with that final conclusion in mind, we could build that model, right? Very easy. And so, you know, when we have things like saying breathing is bad for the environment, you know, you can build that model and you can say that. And if that's what your preconceived outcome is, very easy to build that model. I think most of the people who watch this understand that. But, you know, to bring it back to financial markets, we can build any model we want if we know the outcome, the intended outcome. So, Anthony, what's your thoughts on COP28 and energy?
It is not my world, Tone. It is just, it was great to hear what Michael and Tracy had to say, but I know so little about it, it wouldn't even be worth me commenting. I know to stay in my lane.
Good for you. Thank you. All right, Tracy, what's the outlook on energy prices, specifically oil coming out of COP28? Do you believe that, you know, once this is digested, we're going to see some upward pressure on, say, gas prices, oil prices, as a result of this kind of longer term, I would say, easing of the hard commitment on green energy?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that definitely will, and it has been ever since the decision. You know, we have seen oil prices rise about $2. And we've seen oil prices rather depressed considering the geopolitical issues that are going on in the Middle East right now. And so I think that definitely has relieved some pressure. And I also think that, you know, I not only fundamentally, but I look at this market. The market was very oversold. You have positioning. You know, not people are not short, they're just not long,
right?
Whatsoever, right? And so, any kind of news that is good, then yep. you start that hop on train, right? And then that sort of gets the ball rolling. So, you know, I look at positioning as well. If you look at the CFTC commitment of traders, you know, it's just there was no interest in this market whatsoever, and we were kind of at kind of the lows. Not as low as 2020, but, you know, generally low historically for this market. And so positioning is right now for, and I'm not saying it can't go lower by any means, but, you know, we had good news coming out of COP28 for the oil industry. We had positioning where it was. We have no interest in this market. So, you know, that's not very surprising. Plus, if you see, oil tends to do really well in inflationary environments. And if there are actually six rate cuts coming, which I don't think that there are, but, you know, the market is pricing that in. And so that's very positive for the oil industry, because the oil looks at it as in, you know, I think inflation is
interesting. Okay, last thing, Michael, what are your models telling us about energy and oil and gas?
Okay, I'm slightly different than Tracy there. So this was my number one long call. I think maybe earlier when you had me on earlier in the year, I was long energy stocks. That's completely changed. I'm short. So I have them as underperformers, energy producers, energy service in particular, look like a lot of kind of not so great companies. So tactically, direction, position, intensity is what I do in the model. We're like maybe in the third inning or so in a relative and absolute decline for energy and oil, also physical. So now the only thing that scares me, I was a little bit late at putting this on because obviously in the Middle East, we've got missiles, you know, in the Red Sea every day, two more today, you know, and we don't know what's gonna come out of the blue over there. So I'm vulnerable to something stemming from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict heading, you know, messing up oil supplies. But one other thought on that. So when the economy goes down, energy prices go down, unless it's like 1970s and oil supply is completely shut off. So I'm bullish on some commodities, mainly metals. Like, did you see palladium yesterday? It was like 10 or 12% out of nowhere. 15. So I like the metals. I like gold, silver, platinum, gold stocks, silver stocks. These things, nobody wants to, there's hardly any of them out there, you know, and nobody even knows what they are. But energy stocks, not so great at the moment. As tactical short underperform, they're not included in the number, like, in other words, stocks that went down a lot that are now bouncing. They're not in that book, they're not in that category in my, in my models forecast.
Great. I love it when we have disagreement on this show, guys. This is perfect. So Anthony, thank you so much for your time. Michael, Tracy, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Have a great weekend and have a great weekend. Thanks a lot.